of the EU and of Britain can bring an immediate stop to the genocide in Gaza. It's not going to bring the liberation of Palestine. It is not going to change the overall picture. But if we are looking for an urgent measure to stop the killing, the massive killing, the destruction, Europe can play a far more active and decisive role. And I'm talking mainly about the EU and Britain, a much more decisive role that would bring at least a temporary end to the current Israeli destructive policies on the ground. But the same reason that it's not happening, the same analysis that would apply to as an explanation why Europe is not doing what it could do, it also applies to the question, why is Europe indifferent? When I say Europe, of course, I talk about the political elites, media elite, academia elite in general, are indifferent or inactive towards the genocide in Gaza. So let me go to history and provide, in to my mind, an historical context that I think is overlooked in most of the historical analysis of the immunity that the Zionist project enjoyed from the very beginning of its inception, and Israel as a state enjoyed since 1948. And surprisingly, and that is definitely still bewildering, is still enjoying at this period in time. And one of the major contexts to deal with it is to remind ourselves that Zionism is a European project. Israel, in fact, is a European project. Too many people fall into the Israeli framing of itself as a Jewish state, which obfuscates the fact that Israel is an organic part of Western Europe. And this kind of connection, a very bizarre and very complex relationship between Western Europe and the state that Europe helped to build in Palestine, this very complex and bizarre relationship of hate and love, if you want, of racism and admiration, totally contradictory emotions and positions and attitudes, explains why any dramatic shift in Western European position on Israel would unpack that kind of relationship and impose not only a very simplistic analysis of European complicity, namely how much trade is provided to Israel, how much arms is being provided by the European military industry to Israel, and so on, but far more important of how organic actually Israel is part of Western Europe, and therefore any action by the international justice systems, any action by the political elite, any action by the media elite, any action by the political elite would mean a European self-search and inflicting sanctions or harsh policies or tough challenges, not towards a country outside of West Europe, but towards a country which is part of West Europe. And this is something I don't think we appreciate enough, to understand how difficult it would be for that elite to address Israel according to international law, according to universal codes of behavior, according to the various United Nations definitions of genocide or ethnic cleansing, because it would be almost as if you would direct that kind of accusation today, not towards an historical period, towards Germany, Britain, Ireland, or Norway. The reason that this organic connection exists goes back to the very origin of Zionism. After all, Zionism was a European solution for a European problem. The problem was European racism towards its European Jewish citizens, the inability of most West European countries and Central European countries to accept the Jews as citizens, that eventually led through the rise of fascism and romantic nationalism to the genocide of the Jews in the Second World War. The conclusion of most of the members of the European elite, both intellectual elite, political elite, and academic elite, in 1945, in fact, in the period between 1945 and 1948, was that instead of what some of them were suggested, instead of trying to plead with the Jews of Europe, even those Jews of Europe who already went to Palestine, to plead with them to come back to Europe and build together a Europe which would ensure that another Holocaust would not happen, a Europe that would ensure that it will deal fundamentally and properly with the racism towards Jews so that it could deal in general with the problem of racism. Instead of doing that, what was preferred as an idea was something that was developed before the Second World War as a very minority idea, both among Jews and among Christians, that both for theological reasons and romantic reasons and colonialist reason and capitalist reason, the best thing is to say to the Jews of Europe, you're right, we cannot integrate you, so instead we will build for you a Western European country at the heart of the Arab world, at the expense of the Palestinians. That seems to be a win-win situation for all of us. We don't need you in Europe, and you will have a European state as you want to have, but you won't have it in Europe itself. This is something that explains the very close and organic connection between European thinkers, diplomats, imperialists, and their counterparts in the Zionist movement. The big question, of course, that all the time unfolded was, how does Europe react to the manifestation of the state, to what the state brought with it towards the as a result of its inception, vis-a-vis the people, the native and indigenous people of Palestine? And what is incredible to look at as an historian is to see how elastic and flexible are the supposedly critical voices in Europe, whether these are politicians, intellectuals, academics, or journalists, whenever there is a sense that maybe the actual Israeli actions against the Palestinians, whether it is the ethnic cleansing of 1948, whether it is the Kfar Qasem massacre in 1956, whether it is the expulsion of 300,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in 1967, whether it's the Sabra Ushatila massacre, whether it is the daily abuse of civil and human rights in the West Bank, it is quite incredible to see how diplomats, academics, and politicians all the time develop the narrative which explains why actually the Israeli actions on the ground do not justify any deviation from the fact that Israel is part of us, that Israel is part of the Western world, that Israel is part of the West European world. And even if there is a misbehavior, even if there is a violation of international law or universal values, it is something that has to do with that or other government. And this is temporary, and it doesn't challenge the very ideological and moral fundamentals of the project that Europe helped to, not only helped to establish, but helped to sustain with material help, moral help, and diplomatic help. And that kind of connection or nexus was definitely dramatically tested in the last 2 years, but it withstood the test, unfortunately. It withstood the test because in the only way of pushing Europe, and I insist that Europe is even more important than the United States in changing the reality in Palestine, that the only it shows that even the events on the ground have not created the kind of shift in the basic political, intellectuals, cultural perceptions of Western European elites about Israel and its role in the world, its role in Europe, and so on. That's why the Palestinians became invisible for Europeans. That's why the Palestinians suffering and all the Israeli actions against them were recorded, are very well known, are not ignored as such, but are not leading to any serious contemplation of a different attitude, not towards one Israeli government or the other, but rethinking and reasserting about the project as a whole. And without reasserting and rethinking about the Zionist project as a whole, Europe will not take a tough action against Israel, although I do hope that we don't have to test this with even worse to come, because I can't imagine what could be worse than we've already witnessed on the ground.
Ilan Pape, speaking at the Gaza Tribunal in Sarajevo last May. Pape is an Israeli historian and political scientist and a professor at the University of Exeter's College of Social Sciences and International Studies, where he directs the European Center for Palestine Studies and co-directs the Exeter Center for Ethno-Political Studies. Ilan Pape is the author of A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and 10 Myths About Israel. Pape's most recent work, Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic, was released last year. It's a masterpiece. Mazen Kumsiye again, speaking with me in the garden of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability. Tell me about the institute. Where are we? What is this place?
So this beautiful place with the, you know, here I'm sitting in the fresh air, smelling the nice flowers, and you know, it's an oasis in the middle of Bethlehem. The Zionist colonizers took most of our land. Of course, essentially 97% of the land in what became the State of Israel was Palestinian land, was taken over. That's within the Green Line. Then Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and Sinai and the Golan Heights. So they came here in Bethlehem in 1967. This is Bethlehem where Jesus was born. Bethlehem district is a very large district. It goes from here all the way to the Dead Sea over there, which on a clear day you can actually see the mountains of Jordan there. And if you go up the roof of this building, you can actually see the Dead Sea. It's not very far. So it's a small area. Anyway, the Bethlehem district, 85% of it was taken over for Israeli Jewish-only settlements or colonies. So we're restricted to 15% of the land. And this 15% of the land, you could even videotape later, show how, because people are squeezed, they start to build vertically. So we have buildings going up all around. This remains the only open area, basically, within the city of Bethlehem, with some 400 species of plants. We introduced some plant species here in a botanic garden. We have a museum of natural history. We're building behind me, renovating an older building, making it a larger museum. This is... This institute, why did we start it? As I said, to be like an oasis in Bethlehem, but beyond that, it is a regional and even global hub for biodiversity and sustainability.
In Palestine?
No, global hub throughout the world, and regional hub What does that mean? Why the words biodiversity and sustainability in the name of the Institute, Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability? The idea is that we want sustainability of human and natural communities, and because of this, you cannot have, of course, sustainability of nature without sustaining the humans that are living in that nature, the indigenous native people. And vice versa, you cannot sustain indigenous native people, living next to a protected area, for example, without protecting that area, because we humans depend on nature.
We depend on the resources that the land provides.
The land provides, the plants provide us oxygen, they provide us with food, medicinal plants. Our ancestors never had their modern medicine. They depended on plants for medicine. They depended on these resources that we have.
And water. I mean, all this vegetation, biological diversity holds on to water, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So this is why it's important and why this institute is important. And how does it go about doing this? So it's vision, if you want, is sustainable human and natural communities. But how does it go about doing this? That's its mission and goals. We do this in brief because of time. I mean, research, education, conservation, and community service. These are the four categories of work that we do. In research, we publish on everything from human environmental impacts to colonial activities that destroy the environment, to how we protect the environment, to pedagogy, education. How do I educate children, for example, about climate change? What species are endangered, what is not endangered? How do I protect them? Whether I protect them what's called in situ, in the location that they are present in, or ex situ, outside the location they are present. For example, we have orchids and irises here that we took from the wild and brought them here to grow them and propagate them. In case they go extinct in the wild, we can repopulate the wild with the species from here. This is the idea of conservation. We have an animal rehabilitation unit that's also conservation efforts. We do national strategies, local strategies, and also even global strategies. Some of our members, including me, are experts in conservation, so we are with the International Union of Conservation of Nature, or the Convention on Biological Diversity. We are engaged in various aspects of supporting global efforts to combat climate change and other threats to our environment. And finally, in community service, as I said, we have to protect the community. We have to make sure that our community has sustainable living. So we show them how to, sometimes it's a matter of even reviving their knowledge of how to grow things organically, not use pesticides, insecticides that damage the environment, things like that. So this is what we do in terms of community service. We help, for example, with permaculture, aquaponics, aquaculture, technical information to farmers, advice to farmers, sometimes direct help to farmers, like providing them with seeds and seedlings of native and indigenous plants. Yesterday, you and I planted, for example, some seeds of a local kind of a snake cucumber, they call it, fakus in Arabic. And this is an important way for us to propagate and grow our own food. That's what we call food sovereignty. European Union and others, they like to use food security as a word. I don't like that, food security, because food security can come also from humanitarian aid, and I don't want that. I want food sovereignty. I want to be sovereign on my food production. as an indigenous person, as a native people, we have to be able to produce our own food, which is what our ancestors did for thousands of years.
Mazin Qumsye, what impact does this place have on visitors, Palestinian visitors who come here, particularly young people and students? What do they get out of this, and what's their impression?
Well, where do I start?
Because I've walked through some of these lands, some of your plots with some students, Palestinian students, and it seems to me they're always amazed and excited.
I mean, I'm sitting here looking at two doves on that tree over there, probably male and female enjoying each other's company. We have a couple of new visitors just came in, walking in the garden, enjoying the peace and quiet here, enjoying the nature, enjoying the plants that are blooming. It provides a peaceful feeling. That's number one. But number two, which is very, very important, this provides, how do I describe it? An oasis of hope. It's not just an oasis of calm, it's an oasis of hope, where people see the potential for protecting our environment, the potential for caring for each other, the potential for friendship, the potential for love, the potential for peace. The potential, this earth, by the way, planet Earth, has enough resources to feed everybody. We don't need wars and conflict. I mean, last night we woke at 2 in the morning, you and I, with these missiles and counter missiles and stuff like that over Bethlehem, over Jerusalem. There's no need for that. The Israeli military, by genocide in Gaza, produced more greenhouse gases in the past 6 months than many European countries to damage the environment. I repeat that. The Israeli military alone in 6 months used more greenhouse emission-emitting gases, petrol and stuff like that for jets, than many European countries produce in a whole year, with all their industries, with all their cars, private cars, public transportation, everything else. The military is the biggest environmental threat to humanity. And there's no reason for it. There's no logical reason for it. We could have peace here in a heartbeat if there were not, greedy people who want to get to be billionaires from military-industrial complex, selling weapons, exploiting other people, and using religion and using the language of tribalism, like the Jewish people, to try and justify taking somebody else's land, property, ethnic cleansing us Palestinians. We, as I said, we Palestinians are indigenous people. We have been living here for thousands of years, regardless of religions that come and go, by the way. My family is Christian, for example. Before that, they may have been Jewish or pagan or whatever. They adopted Christianity. When Islam came here, most families adopted Islam. That's their choice, and they changed religions, and we have lived together in peace. Christian, Muslim, Jews, Baha'i, Druze, everybody else. There's no reason why we cannot do that. The only thing stopping us is a foolish, stupid idea called political Zionism, which claims that a Jewish state, is good for the Jews. This is the claim. It's a false claim, of course. It's not good for the Jews. It's the worst thing that happened to Judaism in 2,000 years. And this is not my words that I just said. These are the words of a Jewish person who said this, and Ilan Pappe. In his speech. So I think we have to realize that this is not a good idea to have religions in charge of countries. No matter how good or bad these religions are, we cannot have religions in charge of country or people who claim to represent those religions to be in charge of countries. No, we can have a secular, democratic country for all its people. It's very simple.
Mazen Kumsier is a Palestinian scientist and author. Together with his partner, Jesse Chang, Mazen founded the Palestine Museum of Natural History and the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability. We'll post a video of our conversation with Mazen at greenplanetmonitor.net. Mazen and Jesse welcome Green Thumbs to help tend their gardens and support the Institute's other work. Learn more about going to Bethlehem and volunteering at the Palestine Institute at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When large companies take climate action, it's often because of pressure from policymakers, lenders, or shareholders.
But for a really long time, employees have been an untapped stakeholder group in that wheel of influence that can get corporate CEOs and boards to make different decisions.
Lucy Piper's with the nonprofit Work for Climate, which aims to change that. The group runs a three-month course which teaches people how to push for climate action from within a company.
We had one engineer who was working with us, and he was able to successfully shift his very conservative engineering firm to 100% renewable energy.
Another participant worked for a cycling company and has since been pushing her industry to avoid having the fossil fuel industry sponsor events. Work for Climate began in Australia. But to expand its impact, it's now teamed up with Project Drawdown and other organizations from around the world. Together, they formed the Employee Climate Action Network and consolidated all their tools and resources into one searchable hub. So any employee anywhere can find the support they need to drive climate action at work. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In June, a small roadside grass fire started in Oregon. The fire was only about the size of a hockey rink, but a new satellite orbiting Earth was able to detect it. The satellite is the first in the FireSat program, a network of orbiting satellites that will track fires around the world.
So catch and understand every single fire, understand its growth, where it's moving, how intense it is, what its impacts can be, so that we can make better decisions over time.
Brian Collins is with the Earth Fire Alliance, a nonprofit coalition that leads the FireSat program. The group is currently testing its system, but when they launch three more satellites next year, they'll share the data more widely with first responders and the public.
So a firefighter can make a better decision in the face of a crisis event that is happening. So I'm very excited about that.
By 2030, FireSat plans to have 50 satellites in orbit, providing a near real-time view of fires burning anywhere on Earth.
We want to make sure that we don't miss any parts of the planet. We don't leave certain communities behind because they're under-resourced.
And with global coverage, FireSat would also help researchers better understand how wildfires are changing as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.